You are listening to Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories, a podcast about surgeon scientists, the things they care about,
and why it matters to you.
We're not superhuman.
You don't have time to specialize in both things at once.
The more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this needed to be brought to the forefront.
When you get a bad outcome, how do you manage your own emotions?
That feeling that you get when the patients say thank you, that's why I do it.
Join the conversation. This is Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories. Hi, I'm David for the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. Have you ever wondered how surgeons learn to operate on real patients? Or how medical devices like replacement heart valves are tested before being approved for use in humans? Meet Richard Bianco, the Director of Experimental Surgical Services, or ESS, at the University of Minnesota's Department of Surgery. He spoke to me about giving early career academic surgeons the opportunity to refine their skills, the complex process of medical device qualification, and important ethical implications of using animal models in medical research.
You don't come out of medical school and you don't come out of your first 2 years of residency really knowing how to operate very well. And so if you then spend time with us in experimental surgery, you have become now one of the chief surgeons. As a resident, you're holding retractors a lot. Here, you're actually doing it. We teach residents, we teach medical students, we teach undergraduates, but then there's research. And that's what I do. I do mostly is the preclinical safety of new devices, basically. Implantable devices, class 3 devices, which means that they're at a level where if they fail, the patient is in immediate danger of expiring. So these are the high-risk devices like heart valves, for instance, which is my personal interest. And so we make sure for the FDA and for worldwide regulatory authorities that they're safe to go into the next phase of research, which are clinical trials. So my part is the animal part, where we mimic the human use. Everything's the same. Same technology, same equipment, same instruments, but the patient is an animal, usually a sheep. And then we can use, because we've been doing this so long, we can take that data and then make an analysis of whether that device is safe to go into people. That's what occupies most of my time.
I'm particularly fascinated by this idea that surgeons do need to practice the skills that we expect them to then execute flawlessly when it comes to human patients. How does ESS train surgeons? What does this process look like? What kind of things do surgeons do in order to become better surgeons?
Well, we have let me give you a real-world example. We have Dr. Yuri Malkovich, I can't pronounce his last name, but Yuri is in the lab right now, and he's involved heavily in a new synthetic valve project where we're helping see and helping develop whether this new device, which is synthetic, it's the first synthetic valve, hopefully, to go into humans. So in the course of that, many animals are required to be implanted with this device. And we take that data, and it goes back to the engineers. They redesign based on that data and come back. And Yuri is implanting those valves with assistance. And he didn't start doing that, but now he's at the level where he's actually doing the entire operation. And it's taken about a year to get to that point, but That is experience that's invaluable for when he gets back to the human operating rooms.
Another question that I have, it relates to the broader training mission of ESS. So clearly, training surgeons to improve their skills and to become academic research surgeons is a very important aspect of the training mission. But I understand also that the center has a lot of other staff there. And so does this become an opportunity for other students to gain experience throughout their educational experience?
I'm glad you asked me that. I'm just stepping down from a 10-year stint on the admissions committee for the University Medical School. And I say that because I have a certain affinity for undergraduate students, because a lot of them really don't know what they're interested in or if they're interested in things for the right reason. So I always have at least 10 to 12 undergraduates employed in our laboratory. All pre-med or pre-vet or pre-science, pre-biomedical engineering. And I'm happy to say that over 90% of those get into the program of their choice. And so it's a transitional thing in ESS. They learn how to focus. They learn how to be serious. They learn responsibility. But more importantly, they learn what science and surgical science is all about. They also learn, the pre-vet students, learn how we care for animals, and that the animals are treated as human surrogates with every care that you can imagine. Because a healthy research subject is extremely important, healthy and happy. So undergraduates are extremely important part of our laboratory. But then again, going down another step, we have a very active high school program where we have high school science students from all over the state coming in for tours. And I did this about 10, 15 years ago because of the animal rights message that the high school students were receiving. And the high schools wouldn't let us come to them for some reason. I'm not quite sure why. So I went, and the high school science teachers in the United States were having a meeting in Minneapolis, their annual convention. So I invited myself to speak and invited them to tour our laboratory. They also see the animal housing. We hide nothing from them. We show them echo machines. They can do echoes on their colleagues. At least two or three times a year, I read an essay that ESS was the reason they're applying to medical school or veterinary school. And so I take personal pride in that, and I hope that will be my legacy, getting these high school kids and undergraduate students into the programs of their choice, because that's the next generation.
Animal rights message that kids receive in high school, as you mentioned, of course, can involve a broad range of different topics that might fall under. What has been your experience with how the animal rights movement broadly perceives medical research and surgical research of the sort that ESS is doing particularly?
Well, let's separate the groups. There's the animal rights people, which have very little impact except costing us a lot of money to put security in. Then there's the animal welfare groups, which is a whole different ballgame. They are extremely important. They're extremely important to making the practice of research medicine better. They made us wake up a bit of things that we didn't need to be doing and things that we needed to be doing. So, and I consider myself an animal welfarist. But they don't go to the next step where animals have rights and every animal needs a lawyer and we shouldn't be doing this and we can all do this on computers. The animal welfare people are much more cognitive about this issue. And they've done a lot of good. When I first started this in the 70s, there were problems. There were definite problems. And I can say today that there's very few. And I say that from a lot of experience. I was the institutional official for animal care here for many years. So I was in charge of all the animals the regions owned. And so I know exactly where every animal is and how they were treated. And I did that for 15 years. So I do know of what I speak. I think that we've done a lot of good. We're making sure devices are safe for people. Heart valves in use all over the world were assessed here first for safety, and luckily we have made very few mistakes, and so we've really benefited and made a lot of people better.
I'm very curious about how these changes came about, what things were like when you started, how they are the way they are today, what ESS and your efforts have done to change that. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit more then about the other mission that you mentioned, which is in terms of helping to make medical devices safer. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the issues involved in medical device manufacturing and how devices are brought to market and what role ESS plays in that process.
Basically, the requirements are the same for all implantable devices. It must go through extensive bench testing, which is in vitro assessment. And then promising devices then go into the next phase, which is in vivo assessment, which is the animal phase, the biological reactor, so to speak.
So just to clarify, in vitro is purely laboratory, the device by
bench
itself.
Testing.
In vivo is then in a live organism.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And then, it's not a linear process. We go back and forth from animal to bench numerous times. But so it goes from bench to animal, bench to animal, bench to animal, and then it goes forward into clinical trials. And then extensive multi-center clinical trials are done. Then they apply for FDA approval. And then it goes into general release. So it's a long process and a very expensive process for the manufacturers.
Are these changes things that came about purely because medical researchers figured out that they needed to do things better and more fairly in terms of the process and the animal subjects and then eventually the human experience? Or was it also something that had to do with regulatory changes? And the reason I ask this is because in 1976, of course, the Medical Devices Act brought medical devices under regulatory framework similar to what pharmaceuticals had been subject to before. And so I was just wondering, what's the relationship between the ethical side and then the regulatory side?
Well, it's an interesting question, because to me there's really no difference. If there wasn't a let me clarify what I just said. If it wasn't a regulation, we should still be doing it, because it's an ethical requirement in my view. And I say that because, as I sort of referenced before, most devices aren't ready for people. They're presented to me usually by young engineers or an inventor or something, and they think it's ready to go. And then we show them that it is not ready to go. Now, if it wasn't a requirement or an ethical requirement, that would have gone directly into people in the older days. Not anymore. You can't do that anymore. And I think that's what the regulatory apparatus reacted to. And like every regulation is based on somebody making a mistake or doing shortcutting something. And that's where these regulations come from. And in this case, it's extremely important. The other part of that is that back in the 70s, we didn't have a lot of valid animal models to make these predictions. And so I spent a lot of my career developing models that can mimic human safety. And that's taken me a long time. And we had to publish that. And we had to make sure they were as accurate as we can make them. And that didn't exist in the 70s. That took me pretty much the decade of the 80s to do. And I serve on the ISO, which is the International Standards Organization, which writes these rules. And I'm the animal representative on that committee, and we write the rules. And we can't write rules that people can't do. And so we really had to evolve our practice and then make it a requirement.
Did ESS work closely with the FDA
during
this time period? Talk a little bit about that process. Like, how involved was ESS with the FDA, and how central to the current system is ESS's influence historically?
Well, I don't say influence. we don't have any. I think that the FDA, I have a very long relationship. In fact, the FDA sits with me on the ISO panels. I mean, this is a very collaborative process. And it's worldwide representation, but the U.S. delegation always includes the FDA. So we know each other quite well. They have learned to trust our data out of the University of Minnesota and our conclusions, because we rarely, and this is an ego and this is a lot of people involved, we don't make mistakes very often. In fact, I can't remember. We'll always make, since we don't use statistically significant numbers of animals, it really is subjective, but it's based on 40 years of data and experience. And the FDA has learned to trust that. And they know I don't have a conflict of interest, either financial or any other. And they know our data is what it is, and it's all traceable. In fact, the last FDA inspection here of our laboratory came out with no findings whatsoever, which is unprecedented. They usually can find something. I'm very proud of that. So we work closely together is the answer, but I don't provide influence to the FDA, and I have to be very careful how we communicate with each other, because the sponsor has legal rights of confidentiality.
Because of the strong legacy of medical research in the Twin Cities, there has also been groups that were interested in what was happening with research animals for a long time. It started out as anti-vivisection societies up to animal rights and animal welfare groups. So let's pick up that part of the story, and how did, you know, those groups impact the work that you were doing?
Well, we went through a tough period, and this was the toughest period was the time that we were put on exceptional status by the NIH. And Frank Serra put me to work as an associate vice or assistant vice president, then associate vice president. It really was compliance. In order to get out of the exceptional status with the NIH, we needed to get our house in order. And that meant IRB, that meant animal care, that meant conflict of interest, that meant biosafety, and he put me in charge of all that, which was a nightmare. And I had to keep the lab going at the same time. And as part of my role as IO for both the human subjects and animal subjects, I was the number one target when we had a resurgence of animal rights activity on this campus. Many will remember people hanging from buildings and protests and things like
that. When are we talking about? Give us a time frame.
Oh, in the late 80s, early 90s, and late 80s, basically. That's when they broke into our lab, into Elliott Hall, into the McGuire building, and liberated, quote-unquote, animals. And I was down in Disney World at the time, of course, with my kids. But we had systems in place that dealt with that. But that was the time I had my life threatened. I had my family's life threatened. I had the FBI at my house, parked in front of my house in their big Suburban to provide protection. It was a very tense time. But also I had to keep ESS going at the same time. So it was a turbulent time. I don't regret it, because it needed to be done. And at the end of this, because of people like David Hamilton and other individuals that really worked on this problem, exceptional status was removed. Animal rights people at the same time, I filed a grievance against the Student Organization for Animal Rights for supporting people hanging from buildings and having our fire department have to rescue them. I thought that was irresponsible of our undergraduates to do that. So I filed a grievance and basically won that grievance and put them out of business. And so it sort of calmed down after that.
How did this whole incident come about? I mean, was there some event or some precipitating event that caused a resurgence of animal rights activity in the city at the time?
You know what it was? It was good leadership on their part. They had a couple people. The head of the Student Organization for Animal Rights was a very effective leader. And very committed, and was convinced we were torturing animals. And he had there was no event that he was keying in on. It was just, in general, we were using all these animals and we must be torturing them. And there was no good coming out of that.
What do you think are the challenges in this field moving forward? So where is this going next?
Well, there's some real challenges right now in the animal modeling. Now, the new generation of devices, of heart valves, are tissue engineered devices, which are live cells, or synthetic devices. So we have to make sure our models still reflect human reality, especially with tissue engineered and bioabsorbable heart valves that are designed to go away with time, which is a real hot topic right now. The other challenge, of course, is to make sure we're following the three R's, which is reduce, refine, and replace. Now, I don't think we're going to replace animals in my time, but we're refining our protocols all the time, which means we're also reducing. And the reason we're able to reduce the number of animals is because we've collected data for so many years, and we don't have to do as many because I can refer to that. And so those are the things that we're doing now to make sure that we remain responsive, that we remain predictive, but we also are reducing the use of animals as much as we can. As more simulation occurs, which is really helping with the surgical training, not completely, because if you're going to be a surgeon, you better be doing live tissue at some point in your training. But it has helped tremendously on physicians that really don't want to be surgeons but must go through a rotation. They can do a lot of simulation work, which is very effective.
Based on the work that ESS has done towards the educational mission of the Department of Surgery, I want to ask a slightly different question than I usually ask people at the end of an interview. In terms of the folks out there who might be listening, who are younger folks who are thinking about a career in medicine or a profession in healthcare, what would you say to them about medical training, the future of the profession, and the direction that they ought to go?
Turn off the TV. The medical shows on TV is nothing like that, first of all. And really sit down and think about why you want to do this. There's many aspects of medicine. You don't necessarily have to be an MD. You can be a nurse. You can be a cardiopulmonary perfusionist. You can be a lot of different things that are contributing to healthcare. A physician's assistant. So don't limit yourself to, I have to be an MD or I'm a failure. And I see that all the time. Where they think, I had to take students over to Boynton because they get so depressed about they didn't get into medical school. The second piece of advice is, if you don't get in the first time, which is the majority of students, keep trying. If you're serious about it, keep working at it. Find out, go to the admissions committee. They'll tell you why you didn't get in. They'll tell you exactly why you didn't get in, and then work on that. I see too many people give up. So that's my advice. And don't all of you call me, but call me and I'll give you advice. You come in, you can volunteer. I have a lot of volunteers. I haven't talked about that. But there's many volunteers in ESS that are trying to get some research experience, trying to get some exposure. Now, obviously, I can't put everybody on the payroll, but I can give them these opportunities.
Dick Bianco, Director of Experimental Surgical Services within the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories is a podcast of the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery and is produced by Amanda Brower. Our audio tech is Brian Carnell. I'm medical historian David Korostyshevsky. Join us next time on Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.